This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Rosé. 20 years ago, the mention of it would have had you laughed out of any respectable winery. Considered a sugary, lightweight wine, rosé often came in a box. And while it may have been popular on college campuses, it was not for serious wine drinkers. Flash forward a couple decades, and there are social media pages devoted to rosé lovers, boutique wine labels producing rosé, and rosé wine tours. Rosé has gone from passé to a national craze. It brought in hundreds of millions of dollars last year. So how did a grocery store wine turn into the hottest thing in the Hamptons? Joining us to talk about the rise of rosé is Laura Manick. She's a master sommelier and co-owner of Cork Buzz Restaurant and Wine Bar, with locations in New York and Charlotte. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a bit of history on rosé. It's been around much longer than many of us may think.
Yes, absolutely. They say that the first wines actually were rosé. Ancient Greeks would make field blends of both red grapes and white grapes prior to separating them, and they would actually dilute the wine with water. It was said that, you know, unsophisticated or barbarians were the only ones that drank raw wine, and that the first were just simply, as you can imagine, picking red grapes and white grapes and fermenting them all together with yeast and then watering it down. So it's been around for a long time.
And how exactly is rosé made as compared to red or white wine?
Oh, it's a great question. So rosé is made in essentially three different ways. And the easiest way would just be to take a teeny bit of red wine and blend it with more or a large amount of white wine. And that method is not permitted in the EU for, you know, what they call Appellation wine or AOP wine, except for champagne. So that's one method, just a little bit of red and white. The second method is, it was a byproduct for a while where you would concentrate your red wine. And so in order to concentrate the red color and or flavor, you would just bleed a little bit of the free run juice from the bottom of the tank. And that was used as a byproduct of, basically this style is called saigner, to bleed in French. And then the third way is just a maceration. So instead of macerating your red grapes with your white juice for short periods, for long periods of time rather, you would do it for short periods of time and make that onion skin color or that magenta, slightly rosé pink color.
So if rosé has been around since 600 BC, as you suggest, how did it end up getting a bad reputation?
I think it was really maybe the popularity of brands like Lancer becoming, you know, this off-dry and or very sweet style of wine that was pink. And that really maybe made it popular at one point in the 70s, but then as people started developing a palate for drier styles of wine, then it was looked down upon as an inferior, unsophisticated wine from, you know, our grandparents. And early, you know, 1945 is really when Lancers became popular, and it wasn't until the late 70s that people started saying, oh no, I don't want sweet wine. And just the association was always sweet and rosé.
And White Zinfandel, I mean, I think about that being a grandmother wine, and it gave rosé a bad name.
Yeah, same thing there. And so, you know, Sutter Home and producers such as that were making red wine and making Zinfandel, which is a native grape brought from Croatia to California via Italy. And, you know, they would make red wines from it, and they were trying to concentrate their red wine, made a byproduct, which was White Zinfandel. Originally, they labeled it as Eye of Partridge, but it didn't really take with the, you know, the TTB. So instead, they called it, you know, White Zinfandel. And it was a stuck fermentation that really made that wine sweet. Basically, you can think about yeast eating sugar, turning it into alcohol. But if the yeast somehow die before all of the sugar is consumed, then you have residual or leftover sweetness in the wine. And someone in marketing decided, well, that's a great idea. You know, it's a stuck fermentation. We have to make something good with this, and let's just bottle it as an off-dry, you know, slightly pink wine. And that became popular too, but at the same time, with the popularity, when people felt that the sweetness was no longer, you know, a sign of a good wine drinker, was a dry wine, then it also went out of fashion to drink White Zinfandel.
So yeah, popular while we were into the sugar rush, then the reputation changed. When did you start to see the resurgence of interest after rosé had a bad reputation for almost two decades?
I would say from the mid-2000s, let's call it like 2005 through today, we really started to see increasing a popularity in sophisticated drinkers, novices, enthusiasts, and as well amongst the sommelier and wine community towards drinking rosé from pretty much every country that makes wine.
Why do you think this thing's turned around?
You know, I love rosé, and so I'd love to think that it's because it's somewhere between a white wine and a red wine, and that people really love the refreshing nature of a white, but perhaps want a little bit more flavor and, in some cases, texture via tannin, that drying sensation in your mouth. So, you know, it's an in-between wine, and it first started to see real popularity in places like the Hamptons and this, you know, the Mediterranean and Provence and like right around Marseille, where it was associated with a lifestyle of summer and boating and yachting, actually, I should say. But, you know, honestly, it is a wine first and foremost. Just because it's a pink or orange or a rosé color, it doesn't mean that it's not sophisticated. It can be age-worthy. So I think people are getting more educated about wine, and as a result, I think they're willing to try something that might have not been in their wheelhouse 20 years earlier.
Laura Manick is a master sommelier and co-owner of Cork Buzz Restaurant and Wine Bar with locations in New York and Charlotte. Joining the conversation now is branding expert Martin Buchanan. He is a creative director at Trone Brand Energy, a branding and digital agency in High Point and Durham. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you're a branding expert. How does it work to rebrand an entire category of a product, as opposed, there's not just one company that makes rosé. Rosé is a product made by many. How does it work to rebrand a whole category?
Well, I think that rebranding of a category, if it's deliberate, it might be like the wine council. You know, you think of the way avocados have done it. Just somebody gets behind it and puts money behind the effort. But I don't think that that's the case with rosé. I don't think that there was a concerted marketing effort by a large group.
What do you think happened?
Well, for all indications, it looks like the improvements Laura mentioned about the wine itself kind of meshed perfectly with the lifestyles of millennials, who always like to embrace things that are somehow retro. They call it early onset nostalgia. And they really have, I mean, you look at the things like the popularity of Transformer movies and things that millennials grew up with, they like to reach back in time and find something of their own. And you know, they don't like to be called millennials, right?
Exactly.
We know that. But we're talking about a category of people that happen to fit an age demographic, and they behave in a way that kind of defies what marketing has been all along. They take to social media and they promote themselves. And in doing so, they love to share their wine moments, their outdoor moments. They're also not particular about, you know, the social mores that came before. You know, the rules of wine drinking fall on their deaf ears. They don't care. And so they find this rosé. Nobody's drinking it. Let me try that. Oh, it's pink. Oh, look, it makes a great photograph. I'll post it on Instagram and pop. There goes the color making their feed look great. And then somebody else says, hey, I'll do that too.
Well, Laura, it seems like there was a confluence of factors happening at one time. There were producers sort of making these whirlwind promotional tours, magazine articles declaring it a thing. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie came up with their own kind of rosé. But it also had to do with the fact that the production of it became better, and it was cheaper than some other red and white wines. Can you tell me about those two factors?
Yes, absolutely. And I do agree that, you know, the Instagram-worthy photos, I mean, if you look at the different hues of rosé, you can absolutely say, oh, wow, that's a great picture. And it's contagious, the sales. The quality itself has to match, too. And I think, as we're not calling them millennials, but as that age demographic does want quality, and even though they might not have, you know, the social, I think that it's as a rise of quality, as wine became less of rosé became less of a byproduct and more of an intentional wine made from specific grapes and in a style between white and rosé, red, it became very popular.
What is it that makes rosé more affordable?
I mean, one reason is that, you know, when you're making red wine, you have a longer aging. You generally have either oak use, or you hold back the wine for longer than you do with your rosé. You might even say one of the reasons is because when they do bleed off some of the wine to make concentrated red wine, then that byproduct then becomes sellable. So it just depends on the style, but it is certainly as affordable as some unoaked white wines, which generally become more popular as the weather warms up.
So it might be that it's more affordable. It might be that it tastes better. It might also, and additionally, be this branding effort. Martin, I'm curious to hear you talk about what this question about lifestyle. It seems to me that a lot of what works with millennials in terms of branding is not just about selling a product, but about selling you the kind of life that you live around the product. How has this played a part in the branding of rosé?
I believe that this demographic has embraced a carefree lifestyle with their own rules. They'll put ice cubes in rosé and not worry about that. And guys will drink a pink drink and not feel threatened with their masculinity. I think that's particular to this demographic because they have a different attitude on life. So this plays.
And gender norms are changing and shifting.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't suffer the same kind of insecurities that generations before them might have suffered. I mean, I can remember feeling kind of awkward 15 years ago sitting there with a white wine. I'm like, gosh, do I look, you know. They don't have that problem.
You worked on a specific marketing campaign for a craft beer as they were trying to shift toward a younger audience. Can you tell me about your work and what you learned about marketing to millennials from that experience?
Well, one of the things that this was French Broad beer out of Asheville, and it's one of the original craft brewers over in Asheville, one of the first three. So they were early part of the trend, but they didn't really progress with the rest of the category. They didn't take on a whole lot of different new IPAs and a lot of flavor experimentation. They had a new owner come in. He wanted to rebrand it. So the trick to rebranding a brand that you picture a French lady in a fishnet hose maybe on the cover, French Broad Brewery, what is that about if you don't know that there's a French Broad River? So we introduced the river back into the name and helped the brand stand for cleaning up the river and protecting the environment. We put little river critters on every can, a little, you know, art pieces that reflected their interest in protecting the environment. And they will invest money against that. So that's a cause. And millennials like brands that have a reason other than just, I want to sell you a product, to get behind. So this helped this brand stand for something other than let's make beer. And I think that's a good thing for companies to do. And you see that across every category. And whole entire categories created around let's do good. What's that shoe that, you know, every shoe they sell you?
Tom's shoes.
Yes, they give a shoe to somebody, you know, in a underdeveloped country. I mean, those kind of causes are easy to get behind, and it's clear to say millennials want this world to be a better place.
Laura, is it just millennials drinking rosé in your spaces where you sell alcohol?
No, absolutely not. I think rosé has reached all ages, all generations, and we'll see every age group drinking rosé if it's good rosé, which I like to think we do serve.
Do you think there has been any effort to connect rosé with any kind of greater social cause or any bigger movement that you have seen?
And not in a social cause, but I think rosé is just connected, as we mentioned, with just this carefree, more summer inspired by beaches and pools and the lifestyle of, you know, Aix-en-Provence and Marseille and boating.
Martin, for you, in just about 30 seconds, as someone listening to this, they may think about how, you know, marketers are manipulating our brains to drive us toward particular products. I thought this was free will. I thought I was choosing a rosé out of free will. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think marketers do try to put their product out there. I mean, it's been going on forever. So if the population likes what that product is and embraces it, then it takes off. And marketing is a success. But their job is to take it to market. It's the consumer's job to buy it and like it.
All right. The rosé wave may or may not continue. We will see and have you all back to talk further about it. Laura Manick is a master sommelier and co-owner of Cork Buzz Restaurant and Wine Bar with locations in New York City and Charlotte. Martin Buchanan is creative director at Trone Brand Energy, a branding and digital agency in High Point and Durham. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find more about everything we've spoken about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is the technical director, with Al Wodarski filling in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.